with the projections of declining sea ice, you would expect the waves to get bigger and bigger. And in fact, that's what is being seen in the Beaufort Sea.
In federal Arctic waters, oil production is having to adjust for climate change. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 6th. It's Election Day. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, advocates push to allow on-site consumption of marijuana products.
The law continues to be violated with people smoking in public places because they don't have a place to go.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services.
That's right, it's Election Day. Voters are deciding Alaska's next governor, as well as voting on the state's lone seat in the U.S. House and dozens of seats in the state legislature. In the U.S. House race, Elise Galvin is facing off against longtime incumbent Don Young. The ballot features the names of four candidates for governor, though only three are still in the race: Republican Mike Dunleavy, Democrat Mark Begich, and Libertarian Billy Toyin. Incumbent Bill Walker suspended his campaign last month. Voters will also decide the fate of a controversial ballot initiative on salmon habitat. The polls close at 8 p.m., and polling locations can be found at elections.alaska.gov. As the results come in tonight, Alaska Public Media will have live coverage starting at 9 p.m. with results from around the state and analysis. Well, federal officials will be monitoring voting compliance in select jurisdictions across the nation today, including some in areas of rural Alaska with large Alaska Native populations. There are more than 10,000 voting jurisdictions in the U.S. Of the few dozen selected for federal monitoring, two are in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. They are the Bethel Census Area and the Kusilvuk Census Area. Monitors will be deployed from the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. They will gather information on compliance with federal voting rights laws, including laws that require equal voting access regardless of race, color, disability, or language. The other Alaska jurisdictions being monitored are the Dillingham Census Area and the Yukon-Koyukuk Census Area. The Trump administration gave a key approval to a milestone oil development. It's called the Liberty Project, and it would be the first oil production project in federal Arctic waters. It's being developed by Hillcorp, a Texas-based oil company. But as the Arctic warms, Hillcorp is already having to tweak its proposal to accommodate climate change, and future companies looking to drill offshore in the Arctic may have additional changes to plan for. Ravenna Koenig of Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
To get at the oil, Hillcorp is planning to build a gravel island about 5 miles from shore in the shallow waters of the Beaufort Sea and drill from there. In order to build that gravel island, the company plans to use landfast sea ice, the ice that attaches to the coast each winter. They would drive on top of it and dump the gravel through holes in the ice. Shallow nearshore operations have used sea ice in that way before.
When it's in place and when it's stable, it makes actually a fairly convenient platform from which to operate. You can build ice roads on it. You can operate drilling equipment from it. And it's, I think, in many ways easier than trying to work off of a ship or a barge or something like that.
That's Andy Mahoney, a sea ice researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He provides information to oil companies and federal regulators on what they can expect of ice thickness, extent, and seasonal duration. Mahoney says that the primary concern he hears from oil companies who want to work on landfast ice is that the window they have to work is shrinking as the Arctic warms.
It's forming later and it's breaking up earlier.
And that means that companies may have to stretch out work from one winter to two. That's apparently happening to Hillcorp, according to regulators familiar with the company's construction plans. According to plans Hillcorp shared with a federal agency in 2015, the company originally thought it could build the gravel island in 1 year, but in an email, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, confirmed that due to, quote, historically abnormal ice conditions in the Arctic, unquote, Hillcorp amended its plans. Now, the company is telling the agency it could take 2 years to build the gravel island. Hillcorp did not respond to a request for comment. There are also other ways that a warming Arctic may affect companies who pursue offshore drilling projects.
With the projections of declining sea ice, you would expect the waves to get bigger and bigger. And in fact, that's what is being seen in the Beaufort Sea.
That's Jeremy Casper, an oceanographer at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Casper is currently leading a study for BOEM, trying to better understand wave and sediment dynamics in the area around Hillcorp's Liberty project. One of the things they're going to do is model how wave height, storm surge, and coastal erosion may change along the whole Beaufort coast and some of the Chukchi coast decades into the future as the climate warms. Casper says that those changes could mean that companies have to plan for increasing erosion around their pipelines or alter how they work in higher wave conditions. For example, in shallow areas of the Beaufort Sea.
If you increase the waves, you're talking about bigger boats. Bigger boats, you have to start thinking about dredging because it's pretty shallow up there.
Earlier this year, the Trump administration proposed opening the majority of Alaska's federal waters to drilling, including Arctic waters. A final plan has yet to be issued, and lease sales have yet to be held. But as warming temperatures change the Arctic landscape, it's hard to imagine that any future drilling operation in Arctic waters could avoid calculating in the effects of climate change. For Alaska's Energy Desk, with help from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Public comment ended last week for the latest draft proposal to allow customers to smoke or consume marijuana products in licensed retail shops. On-site consumption has been talked about since voters first approved a ballot initiative legalizing recreational marijuana in 2014. Alaska would be the first state to authorize public consumption of marijuana products. KTOO's Adeline Baxter has more on the proposed changes in store for retailers.
Right now, people can only legally use marijuana in the privacy of their own homes. That means tourists coming off the cruise ships have nowhere to go if they want to try Alaskan cannabis. But the latest proposal to change state law has people in the marijuana industry like Herb Smythe feeling hopeful.
We really need one because the law continues to be violated with people smoking in public places because they don't have a place to go.
Smythe's new business, Alaska Kush Company, soft opened about a week ago in downtown Juneau. Right now, it's just a retail shop. But store manager Amy Herrick said they want the eventual layout of the space to include a cafe where customers can sample products.
You know, a place where the community can come together and enjoy what they enjoy. A lot of people don't appreciate alcohol, so the bar is not the best setting.
They plan to fully open at the end of November. Smythe says the cafe element was part of his original business plan, but they're prepared to be patient as this latest proposal moves forward.
So we would like to see that, you know, advanced. We've positioned ourselves so that we could do that. If, you know, we'll use this space in other ways until that's approved.
Under the proposal, licensed retail stores interested in on-site consumption will apply for endorsements approved by the Marijuana Control Board. Erica McConnell with the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office says this is the second on-site consumption proposal the board has considered. The first proposal failed in 2017 with a 2-3 vote, but a new version was introduced shortly after. A couple of things have slowed down the process, such as a board vacancy this past year, but McConnell said the main thing is the lack of precedent.
So the board is very cognizant that we're sort of at the forefront of what public consumption might look like, and so they don't want to rush. And they want to try to be very thoughtful about it and give people a lot of opportunity to comment and make sure that they that in the end they have the best proposal possible.
The proposal also includes language that allows local governments to opt out of on-site consumption by ordinance or ballot question. According to McConnell, the proposal received feedback from more than 60 individuals during the 60-day public comment period. The board will hear oral comments at a public hearing on December 19th. The next day, they'll meet to consider approving it. If any substantial changes are made, McConnell says, it will go back out for public comment. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
Some Alaska residents say a shortage of available family housing is having a snowball effect on the community. The Kodiak Daily Mirror reports residents of Larsen Bay say the lack of available homes is making it difficult to attract more families to the village, thus forcing the closure of the local Larsen Bay school. Some residents say the homes are being purchased by people from outside the state who maybe only used the home for a couple weeks. Data provided by the Kodiak Island Borough's Resource Management Officer shows there were 140 properties in Larsen Bay listed on the 2018 tax roll. Of the total number of properties, 74 are owned by individuals with a mailing address in Larsen Bay. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at how the state translates ballots for non-English speakers.
This work addresses deficiencies in the democratic process that have gone back for a whole generation or two.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The U.S. Supreme Court has again heard Alaska hunter John Sturgeon's challenge to National Park Service authority over Alaska rivers. It's the second time the High Court has considered Sturgeon's suit, which seeks to overturn a nationwide Park Service ban on hovercraft use. As applied within Alaska's federal conservation units, it's a case that has broader states' rights and potential subsistence management implications. Yesterday morning, lawyers representing Sturgeon, the state of Alaska, and the National Park Service presented oral arguments before the Supreme Court. The last time the High Court considered the case, it remanded to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which in 2017 again ruled in favor of Park Service authority. The current arguments are focused on federal reserved water rights as they are applied in Alaska, where the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act guarantees certain access. The Supreme Court will issue a decision on the latest arguments in June 2019. A faith-based Anchorage women's shelter is suing to block the city from requiring it to accept transgender women. Lawyers for Alliance Defending Freedom filed a motion in federal court seeking an injunction to stop the city from applying its gender identity law to the Hope Center shelter. The conservative Christian law firm based in Scottsdale, Arizona, says homeless shelters are exempt from the local law. The shelter operators filed a federal lawsuit against the city and its Equal Rights Commission in August, months after a transgender woman complained to the commission that she was denied entry at the shelter. Plaintiffs say the individual identified only as Jessie Doe showed up inebriated after hours and was not turned away because of gender. City officials could not immediately be reached for comment. The National Institute of Justice says 4 in 5 Native American and Alaska Native women will experience some kind of domestic violence in their lifetime. It's a subject that's long been whispered about, but now recent headlines about victimized Native women have sparked a larger conversation and calls to action in Indian country. Correspondent Emily Schwing reports.
Since last January's Women's March in Seattle, hundreds of Indigenous women have gathered in the Northwest to raise awareness of those who go missing, who are abused or murdered. Now demonstrations like this are also happening in Alaska's largest city.
End the violence! End the violence! Stop the silence!
Stop the silence!
More than 100 people gathered for a rally in downtown Anchorage last month. They carried signs, some wore traditional Alaska Native regalia. Charlene Upbuck is an organizer.
This is really hopeful, you know, that we're doing this and we've come together under a lot of hurt.
Upbuck is among the many Alaska Native women publicly sharing stories of domestic violence and sexual abuse. And women in leadership are publicly supporting their efforts.
Having those discussions are painful.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, Tara Sweeney.
Folks are vulnerable, and they need to happen if we're going to break this cycle.
Sweeney, who's also Alaska Native, wouldn't comment on specific federal-level policy changes that might better protect Native women from violence and assault.
I can tell you this. I'm open to working with members of Congress on this issue. And as policy proposals come forward, we are open to weighing in on those.
And congressional candidates are taking this on during election season. At a recent debate for Washington State's 5th District U.S. House seat, Democratic challenger Lisa Brown chided incumbent Republican Kathy McMorris Rodgers.
My opponent voted to weaken the Violence Against Women Act, specifically to weaken the protections that Native women would have on tribal land.
But McMorris Rodgers defended her record.
On the Violence Against Women Act, Lisa doesn't have it quite right. I supported the current policy. I supported the legislation that President Obama signed.
I think it is fair to say it is a huge issue on people's minds.
For nearly 40 years, Julie Kitka has worked for Alaska's largest Native organization.
But it is not new.
Kitka is now the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. She says what is new is how and where conversations about sexual assault and violence against women and children are happening. And that's out in the open.
It is an evolving issue. When I first started, this never would have been talked about.
For now, ending violence against women is mostly a grassroots effort. And notably, even Native men, who normally stay quiet about intimate and controversial matters, are stepping up. Samuel Johns walked around with a petition during AFN's annual convention in Alaska this year.
Hey, how you doing, man? I'm walking around with this pledge. It's for men to sign.
Men who sign agree only to engage in consensual, verbal, and physical contact with women and to disrupt situations where men are harming, harassing, or sexualizing women and children.
Why would you sign this?
Why would I sign this?
Because yeah.
I have three daughters, you know? I have three daughters, and I hope that the world is a better place for them.
On that day, Johns gathered more than 50 signatures. Whether other men who signed on will stick to their agreement, only Alaska's Native women will know for sure. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Unhappy teachers staged a demonstration at yesterday's Anchorage School Board meeting, upset about curriculum changes and wages, among other things. The meeting was packed with educators dissatisfied with the current contract negotiations between the school district and the union. Greening Middle School teacher Kadra Peterson urged the board to step in.
If you want to know what it is like to run ASD without the backbone of educators, this is what's coming.
Following Peterson's testimony, 300 to 400 educators, by her estimate, walked out of the meeting. Peterson says the group's main point of contention with the district are requirements introduced at the elementary and middle school levels that she says restrict teachers to, quote, scripted lesson plans and add workloads to teachers while sacrificing time spent with students. ASD Deputy Superintendent Mark Stock disputed claims that the priority plans, as Stock called them, were restrictive and scripted. He said that the district implemented new, more descriptive lesson plans to help increase academic performance, particularly reading, among elementary school students. Teachers say they want more academic freedom.
Their cry is that we want to be able to teach those materials, you know, however we want. And one of the challenges to that is that, you know, currently we have such a significant number of our students that aren't reading well, and currently that academic freedom has always existed.
The contract negotiations have also been stalled due to the large difference in wage proposals between the two groups. The teachers wanted an increase that Stock says would cost $54 million. The teachers say their current pay isn't competitive. The teachers' union and district began a second round of mediation today and will continue tomorrow. The two other topics of discussion that drew testimony involved the potential closing of J-Bear-based Mount Spur Elementary and a proposed French language immersion program at O'Malley Elementary. Both topics are scheduled to be voted on at the next board meeting on November 19th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Do you need health insurance but think you can't afford it? Well, did you know that Alaska's individual market health insurance premiums are going down again for 2019? If you need insurance or currently have insurance through the individual market, be sure to shop at healthcare.gov between November 1st and December 15th to confirm that you have the plan that best meets your family's budget and coverage needs. You may also call 1-844-PLANS-AK for local help. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Alaska has a federal mandate to provide language assistance to voters who need it. KTOO's Zoe Gruskin reports on how election materials are translated and why.
Every official ballot cast in Alaska this election will be printed in English, but for voters whose primary language isn't English, they'll likely find assistance in a familiar tongue.
This work addresses deficiencies in the democratic process that have gone back for a whole generation or two, in which Alaska Native voters were really disenfranchised.
That's Indra Arriaga. She works for the Alaska Division of Elections with the ungainly title of Elections Language Assistance Compliance Manager.
And I rarely use it because it's so long.
Arriaga heads the state's program to translate elections materials. Right now, there are 10 full ballot translations available, 8 Alaska Native languages and dialects, as well as Spanish and Tagalog. For historically unwritten languages, the state provides oral assistance, most often in the form of recordings. Voters can use the translations side by side with the official ballot, the one that gets counted, reading or listening to translations of each section, then marking their choices on the English version. Arriaga doesn't write the translations. She oversees translation panels. Made up of fluent speakers, most of them elders, these panels pick apart dense election materials, line by line.
These are complicated measures that have huge impacts on the everyday lives of people. And when you read a ballot, it's usually so complicated that it's very difficult to understand even in English.
The panels take that jargon and break it down. They want their translations to make sense to voters in their rural, majority Alaska Native communities. That means explaining concepts like the good old boy network or even candidate. Arriaga says the translations are typically much longer than the English original.
And I think that actually the translations that we do in Alaska Native languages, and this is simply my gut feeling, is that the translations are probably better.
And that matters, especially for Alaskans without much access to lawmakers. Arriaga recalls working this summer in Nustuyahak, a Yupik village of about 500 near Dillingham. Their task? To translate Ballot Measure 1. That's the controversial initiative that would beef up protections for Alaska's salmon habitat. Like many villages in the state, Nustuyahak relies on the salmon fishery for both subsistence and income.
So there are a lot of emotions that are attached to it, you know, regardless of where they stand on it.
That could be a problem.
And, you know, my job then is to work with them so that even though they may have concerns, we have to translate what is there. And that is where working with a panel is really important.
The panel members help each other find the right words and hold everyone accountable, keeping out personal opinions and biases. Arriaga sees the project as a piece of something much bigger for all Alaskans.
I want them to understand how important it is for Alaska. It helps everybody. You don't have to be Alaska Native to support this. You don't have to be a speaker of any language to support this, because the benefits of diversity and the benefits of a multilingual society is huge.
In Juneau, I'm Zoe Grieskin.
New equipment has been used at LeConte Glacier near Petersburg to get never-before-seen data from the ocean floor. As Angela Denning reports, the new information could change the way scientists look at glacial melt.
LeConte Glacier rises 200 feet above the water in a bay southeast of Petersburg. There's another 500 feet of it under the water, with giant blocks of ice regularly breaking off. To safely collect data, a team of scientists last year created remote-controlled unmanned kayaks to go near the surface of the ice. This year, technology advanced even further, and scientists have gathered more information about how the glacier is retreating, specifically how the ocean water is eroding the surface of the ice. They used
a kayak towing a raft.
That's Jonathan Nash, an oceanographer who helps lead studies at the glacier. He says the raft carries 1,000 pounds of equipment, which they dropped to the ocean floor in different spots in front of the glacier. They stayed there for 2 weeks.
Nobody's ever tried to do this before. So this is kind of like sending off a little Mars rover or something. So we sent it a little code. We went beep, 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 boop. And then the instrument said, I'm here, and it came to the surface.
That alone was an engineering feat. But the new data it recorded was even better. Scientists had already collected measurements along the glacier of currents, temperature, and salinity, but nothing constant.
So there's cycles of tides, there's changes in winds, there's changes in the temperature of the ocean waters, and then there's changes in things like the rainfall.
LeConte is like a laboratory for glacier scientists. It's accessible and is the southernmost tidewater glacier in the Northern Hemisphere. What they learn there can translate into glacial melt research happening in other places, like Greenland. Nash, who is with Oregon State University, and other scientists have been researching LeConte for 2 years with funding by the National Science Foundation. That wrapped up in 2017. New funding from the National Geographic Society allowed them to keep going. The team has been focusing on a process called feedback. That's where a freshwater river running underneath the glacier meets heavier saltwater. The freshwater rises hundreds of feet to the surface in front of the glacier, pulling with it warmer saltwater. The more feedback occurs, the faster the glacier erodes. Recording in front of the glacier for 2 weeks is giving researchers a much more detailed look at the variables. They've learned that the ocean bottom near the glacier is not stable. In 3 days, it rose 20 feet, then dropped 20 feet, and then dropped another 20 feet.
And so the terrain down there, we actually don't really know what it looks like, but it's an extremely dynamic spot.
They're also finding that the rate of ice melt from feedback is greater than they predicted, which would change their previous models. Nash says international climate models include general rates of glacier erosion, but
there's no physics in them. What we're hoping to do is get all the components of that physics together so that we can put those into one of these models.
Besides the new data collected at LeConte, the scientists continued other research, such as capturing images of the glacier from various angles above and below the waterline. And they recorded the sound of the glacier, which could be another way to study how fast it's melting.
Glacier ice has little pockets of air inside, and that air is at super high pressure. And when it melts, they all go psst, and they pop, and they create a hissing sound that you can pick up. And so the more hissing, the more melt.
They'll work on the collected data over the next couple of years, coming up with a new model they can test on other glaciers, like in Greenland. Nash says current models show ice melting there would raise sea levels a few feet within 100 years. If all ice there melted, sea levels could rise 20 feet eventually. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Ravenna Koenig and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Adeline Baxter and Zoe Gruskin in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Anchorage, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is David Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. Alaska Startup Week is November 12th through the 18th, featuring events in 9 communities across the state. The week brings entrepreneurs, local leaders, and community members together. More at alaska.startupweek.co. This message is sponsored by Alaska Startup Week. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.